in, online, or via podcast. Hello, I'm Paul Barclay. Great to have your company for Big Ideas. In this edition, four Indigenous musicians, Shelley Morris, Fred Leone, Kutcha Edwards, and Jupara, share their experiences of growing up in a society that was far from kind, welcoming, and inclusive. In this wide-ranging conversation, they talk about how they rediscovered their roots, culture, and identity, and what they are doing to help others in their communities on a similar journey. Let's head now to Katoomba, just west of Sydney. We're at Heartlands, the cultural stream of the Blue Mountains Music Festival. And to set the scene and introduce our speakers, here's your MC and moderator, RN's Greg Borschman.
Welcome again to Heartlands and the ancient lands of the Gundungurra and Darug peoples. Today, identity, language, culture, they're at the heart of how we all define ourselves as individuals and a society, and especially so for Indigenous peoples. So today we explore identity and culture and music and language being used to turn around some of those depressing statistics for health, for life expectancy, prison rates, suicide, that blight the prospects and the future of Indigenous society. Shelley Morris, Kutcha Edwards, Fred Leone and Jupara have all worked hard at uncovering the fractured secrets of the past. Sometimes against the odds, all have survived and triumphed. They're now passionately committed to reinventing and reviving culture and language for the generations to follow. So please, a warm mountains welcome for our Indigenous trailblazers, Shelley Morris, Kutcha Edwards, Fred Leone and Jupara. It's funny sometimes the places you start. Kung Fu Panda 2, the 2011 Hollywood movie. The soothsayer tells Po, the panda, "Your story may not have had such a happy beginning, but that doesn't make you what you are. It's the rest of your story, who you choose to be." Shelley Morris, what does that mean to you?
Well, it just means that, well, for me, growing up with no identity, no Indigenous identity, and Mum and Dad had realised how important that was, and I was just lost, and they knew that I was lost, and it didn't matter how much they loved me, they could never make me feel like I fitted because I didn't fit in society. But now, obviously, you know, they're my yesterdays. I fit and I belong to a very large clan, and of course I belong to my mum and dad who grew me up, and now we're just one big family.
We're going to explore some of that later on. You said you became a very naughty girl.
Yeah, very naughty. Well, I suppose I got really angry because I couldn't understand in my beautiful home that I grew up with, who loved me very much. And I'd walk out the door and I was called dumb and stupid and a thief, and you know, my school teachers said I'd never get a job even in a garbage dump. So, and then as soon as they saw I was Aboriginal at school, I was quite bright, and they just put me from the high classes down to the lowest class because they said that, well, she's got to be dumb. And that was really, you know, I suppose you carry it. I carried it. And then I became very rebellious and a very naughty girl.
Kutcha Edwards, you were a ward of the state for 17 years. This was the state, the governments of the day, and perhaps even the Queen of England, promising that they would do their very best to look after you. Mm-hmm. Did they, or were you and your family failed?
You try and articulate what has transpired in your existence, and I really don't think about it because it was what it was and it is what it is now. But to be subjected to those policies and because of indifference, when that indifference was all we had as Aboriginal people. And then interference into the outside influences that came to this country point the finger at you and say to you and your people, we're going to try and change the who you are and what you are, and you will live the way that we expect you to live and be. And for that to happen, not only to this individual, but Shelley sitting here and any other, you know, somebody conversated about Bobby Randall this morning, and obviously Archie and Ruby and everybody else who sings about what has transpired in our journey. And to put it into words doesn't give it proper credence and understanding.
How did you discover, how did you go about finding who you were, where you belonged, where you came from?
I was regimented very early in the children's home. And, every day exactly the same. And I met my mother when I was 6 years old, and the reality is that I was scared of her. How could you do that to a child, you know what I mean? To put it into words is disheartening. But then I went to go live with her when I was 13. So 7 years later, I get to live with this amazing woman who educated me, not only that she is my mother and my little brothers and sisters, but this new way of life, this understanding that what is yours is now ours, and what is ours is yours. And my mother taught me that. And she's, to me, she is and will always be the best psychiatrist that I've ever gone and seen. I will never go see a psych or anybody like that. I deal with the situation at the time because I understand that my understanding is that some of the thoughts that I have are not mine. They're coming from a higher plane. And so I follow those intuitions and those ideas. And I really believe that if we don't, as Aboriginal people, connect to those messages and stop connecting with this and connect with those ideas, then we're going to be better off, because they are the true messengers of our destiny and of who we are as physical beings sitting right here, you know. Yeah.
Fred, I'm just wondering how you figured out who you were. You're a man who's got Indigenous and South Sea Islander heritage. What sort of tensions, what sort of conflicts did that produce?
Aboriginal, South Sea, my great-grandfather and great-great-grandfather were brought over with the sugarcane industry, indentured labour, slavery basically. And my dad's Tongan. And then those two old fellows from South Sea Islands, Gela Island, Tanna, married into the Butchala people, which is my grandmother's mole. Growing up in an urban setting, being an Indigenous kid in an urban setting, there's information overload, and I find today not necessarily the right information. So too many choices. And so you've got this 60,000 year old culture here right in front of you. And Uncle said to me, when I first met Uncle years ago, he said to me, you know, when you think you're doing that alone sometimes, eh? And I said, yeah. He goes, look in the mirror. And he said, when you look in the mirror, those eyes that are looking back at you, they're not your eyes. They're your grandfather's eyes, your mother's eyes. Every generation back to the beginning of time that's been here, they're staring straight back at you. And that's when you're going to walk straight, they're coming with you. And they're all there. So when he's talking about higher power, I think, for me, it's it was just about the search. And the search is always happening. It's like people talk about lifelong learning. It's true. You're always searching. We're always searching as human beings. But to try to navigate through all the crap with, you know, Instagram, I'll probably walk off and upload a picture to Instagram. You got Twitter, you got Facebook, there's turn on TV, MTV, you've got all this stuff that's going on that stimulates you. So how do you stay focused is, I think for me, it just came out of a sense of urgency. Seeing, growing up in the Aboriginal community in Brisbane and sitting around as a little child, sitting around the card table and listening to all the old girls talking about who's related to who's mob, and if mob come to town and they sit down, they come and play cards, and you listen and hear all these stories. There's not that for this generation of young people. So the connection is as much as the assimilation policy and missions and the like destroyed a lot of that. Now it's just, you know, it's just a part of globalization, I suppose, and big business and industry just wanting a piece of your soul when you have, you know, we have something that makes us all unique as people that we should possibly grasp onto as hard as we can. Yeah.
Djibiru, you grew up in Papua New Guinea, and who did you think you were? Filipino? Melanesian? Certainly not Indigenous Australian.
No, with all of those different bloods, it came from all our great-grandparents, really, the mixture. The benefits of it now are, if there's a UN seat in the UN General Assembly for Melanesia, pick me, because of those bloods, you know. So we got, on our Aboriginal side, she was a girl from Jabra Jabra country in WA, and she was put on a boat, and they landed with
this is your maternal grandmother.
It's my great grandmother. So she was on the first boat when the Catholics landed in Papua New Guinea.
So she was stolen.
Yeah. Oh, the history or where and how is not. There's no information. But we did find her, and took only 1998 to actually, they found us. We kind of almost gave up looking. And it was just documentation went missing. The Catholics. It was like, oh, sorry, that church burnt down. Oh, the other church burnt down. So anyway, there was the searching going on. But we were lucky to find evidence through seafarers who produced books and put things together, and we found them in the State Library of New South Wales. It was like, oh, there she is, kind of thing. So, but she married a Filipino, one of the other workers, and these guys were brought to build the churches, the, you know, whatever the Catholics needed when they, on their invasion day. And on my mother's side, that's where the Surabayan, two Surabayan guys, good-looking fellas, I think. They ended up in Papua New Guinea as part of that whole British Empire of, you know, they were sent there to set up the rubber plantations for the English, the British, because I think the Dutch were winning that rubber plantation game. So they were brought in and they married a couple of Papua New Guinean girls and everyone was happy and bing. Yeah, so that's kind of where my roots are. But growing up in Papua New Guinea, we were mixed race. That was our classification. And not just mixed race, we're the Asian mixed race. There's white mixed race, and they were the flash ones. And beneficial-wise, they were given way more benefits than what we, the Asian mob, were given. So growing up, it wasn't till really... when I came down to Australia, then all of a sudden, because of our lack of connection here, then, okay, let's start looking for who we are. Like I said, went to Broome, Coles, I think it was aisle 22, ran into an elder there who passed away in 2004, and he kind of said, "What are you doing here? When did you arrive?" And then when we got closer, he was yelling out. And he goes, "Oh, I thought you were one of our nephews. Went to Perth." And he said, "Who are you?" And I said, "Oh, Adrian Fabila, Spanish black fella." And then he said, "All right." who's your families? And I says, oh, Rosie Bombazak. Where the FNL have you been? And that's where it happened, 1998. And we then have
in all 26
we found
comes.
Out that, hey, we got a, well, there's 2,000 of us over in the east, and we got 2,000 over this side. So then our army's gotten bigger.
I want to come back to you, Kutcher, because we've got limited time with you. We're going to travel some of the difficult areas of Indigenous culture today, and I want to talk to you about your work in prisons, because you've quite often visit prisons and do work with prisons. We'll come to Shelley too, because she's been involved in a very big project in the Northern Territory. But why did you start going to prisons?
I think it goes back to my childhood. I think because that I was institutionalised, that I had an affinity. And you get asked to come and visit because you're a muso and you want to spread, you know, the song line. But then I went on, I was doing a bit of radio at 3CR Community Radio in Melbourne, in Fitzroy. And I went on to, as a co-founder of a radio show called Beyond the Bars. And Beyond the Bars is a program. We're into our 14th or 15th year of this program, where we go in and we talk. It had never been done before in Australia. Talk live to air in the maximum security prison in Port Phillip, and a guy by the name of Kelvin Anderson was the general manager. And a guy by the name of Jay Estanino, who was the programs manager at 3CR at the time. We all went out, and Sean Braybrook, who was the ALO at Port Phillip Prison. And we sat and talked to Kelvin Anderson, and he said, oh, what a great idea, you know. I want to tick the box because I want to be the first person to... So it really started off about him, not about the men. But, an honourable man. But... he went on to become the commissioner for the Officer Corrections in Victoria. So every time that we ask, can we start a new prison, Deer Park Women's Prison, and then on to... So there's now seven prisons that we go to over NAIDOC Week, and we do live broadcasts to you know... And the advent of the internet... guys from, let's say, Cairns, who were doing time in Victoria, can say directly hello during NAIDOC Week to their families. Admittedly, the kids can't, but the mothers and the fathers get to say hello to their kids during NAIDOC Week and send out messages and be proud of themselves during NAIDOC Week. And to me, there's nothing better than giving. Too many of us want to take. Mm.
Kutcher, I'm wondering why we're seeing the revolving door. I mean, for example, imprisonment rates in the Northern Territory are four times higher than any other state. And you must see kids and youth and people you know, friends and family, sort of backwards and forwards. What's going wrong?
Great question. But I'm one individual in the whole cog, in the whole engine. But, you know, the reality is when you start imprisoning children at 18 months old, might have thought it was for our benefit and betterment, but the reality is when you're doing it to children, and then when they're 25 and 26 year olds, they're re-engaging in the justice system. What is justice in reality? Where, you know, they lock us away because we're trying to numb the pain, do you know what I mean? May do something stupid when we're drunk or do something silly because you've got to get to a funeral, so you may go and borrow a car and never take it back. But, you know, they're the injustice. What is justice, you know, to our people? We're the most imprisoned people per capita in the world. What an indictment on human rights. But... Yeah, time's flying, Greggy, and I've got to go to a gig at 12:30.
Yes, but, yes. Yeah. Kutcher, well, look, yeah. Thank you. We'll, yeah. We appreciate Kutcher's playing over the road at 12:30. Yeah.
I'll see you later. Huh?
It was a pity we started a little bit late because we did come up against Kutcher's next gig. Shelley, I want to come to you because you were involved with the musical theatre adaptation of the documentary film Prison Songs. It was rated the great success of last year's Darwin Festival. And how did that project come about? Why did that project strike such a chord?
Obviously, I worked on the film.
Yeah.
Prison Songs, which was the documentary musical of inmates in Darwin's Berrima prison. And I was there from the first discussions. And I'd, like Kutcher, been invited in to sing and do workshops with the women. And I suppose it never really hit me until I started working on the film, because I'd only be ushered in and out, and big mob black faces. And then when I worked on the film and was there every day, I realised, wow, there's heaps and heaps and heaps of black fellas here. Like, it's outrageous.
The figures are incredible. 86% of men and women in prison in the Northern Territory are Indigenous, and 96% of those in juvenile detention. That's almost impossible to comprehend.
Yes, it is. 25% of the adults are there because of unlicensed and not being able to. And I suppose if we go back to the history of where most of the families are from, are very remote communities. And often English might be their fifth language or fourth or third. And so in Berrima, like the film explains, you know, people are in their clan groups because of the language that they're able to communicate with each other. And you've got to understand the West is very confusing and the laws are very confusing. And, I mean, I've travelled throughout about 70 remote communities now over 18 years. And then I started to understand a little bit more about why these things might happen. And I feel like a lot of the times the men have lost their role in the bush. You know, they're no longer hunting for the food. And the women still have the role of nurturing the children. And our kids are bored. You know, there's 2,500 people in a remote community and there's one shop. That, you know, and where's all the employment and where's the opportunities? And I've been talking to the governments about the opportunity of micro-business and the opportunity for people to do what they do, whether it's fishing, and, you know, tourism, you know. But, yeah, it seems to be a battle that we shouldn't really be having in 2016.
Mm. Tupuru, you visited the Rebe Juvenile Detention Centre in Sydney, in Campbelltown, recently, and that was a pretty confronting experience for you.
Yeah. It was a couple of years ago. Well, my access to Rebe and a lot of other, well, Roeburn Prison, and we do a lot of work in Wacol as well, in the juvenile centre, and it's through the education system. So me getting in there was, they do have that school in there that gives me access. But yeah, that was a weird one, where bringing the gear in to prison guards, one opens, one shuts, and the process goes in. You know, I needed to go toilet, one goes in, checks everything, shuts the door. It's three of us have to go, and guys have to listen to me. And anyway, that's how they manage all these kids. And when we were in there, there was 48 odd kids in there. 43 were Aboriginal kids.
43 out of 48.
Yeah. Yeah, and with that same system. So, like, the guys were telling me, I'll have to get it right now, it's probably gone way up in price now, but they were then, it was around about the $200,000 a year per kid to run all that security for these kids. And you've got to remember, their age between 10 and 16.
You could run some really good social programs for that money.
Get more didge players in there. Yeah.
So what's going on? I mean, you told me that, you know, you see cousins going in and out of prison. Why are we seeing this? What's happening?
I think where Fred kind of mentioned before, you know, that urbanised, for us especially, you know, we kind of grew up in towns, and it is that, depending on where you grew up, but when you look at most of my cousins who are in this issue, so most of them in Logan, I think the equivalent would be Campbelltown or Western Sydney here. So I think when you're in this full-on housing commission areas where, you know, I'd call it oppression, you know, places for oppression, and they work perfectly for all races now. But when you've got kids growing up there, the access to drugs, the access to everything that is anti-police, anti-whoever's in charge of us, it grows really well, you know. Armies are made from poor people. And I think that's a great breeding ground for that. And we just see that when we go and visit these juvenile centres. You find out where all the kids are from, and it's those poor areas. Mm.
Fred, what are you seeing in Queensland amongst your peers? Have you got friends or family in prison? I mean, has it become a normalised thing for you?
Yeah, I saw it a lot growing up. A lot of my family, cousins, mates in our general community, black, white, you know, low socioeconomic area. It's a low socioeconomic area, and if there's no money in that area, things are going to happen, things are going to implode upon themselves. So, and I think, for me, when you asked that question to Jubra a minute ago, I sort of have this way of thinking around what, you know, the numbers are scary. And nobody sort of looks at, everybody's saying, oh, what's going on in the community? What's happening in the community? When, you know, when I was a kid, I was a little kid. I was playing Tiggy with my cousin. I was about 11 years old, just to put this into context for you. We ran up around the block, we come back, and I was demonised straight away. I get back to the front of my auntie's house, and there's a police officer standing over in the corner. He said, "You, stop. Where are you going? Put your hands up. Put your hands up." What? And I'm like, "What? Mum!" I ran inside. Mum came out and said, "What's going on?" He's going, "I told him to stop. I gave him an order. He said, that kid's under arrest. He's coming with me. And I said, "Why?" I go, "Why?" He goes, "Do you know anything about this stolen car? Somewhere in the same suburb, somewhere, I don't know. I had on singlet, stubbies, running around. I was a little kid." So when you've got this mentality, an intergenerational demonisation of Indigenous people, like I've got mates that meet me or meet Joop, or, you know, and they say, "Oh, I've never met a black fella before in my life, but all I heard was this, 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 this." And so if you times that by however many, you know, people are out there in the world that aren't forward-thinking or aren't conscious of the world around them and other people's lives, or the fact that, yeah, there's all this dysfunction, but at the same time, you know, I want to start a program where, like an adopt-a-cop for schools, but for Aboriginal communities, where new recruits are forced to spend 1 year, 2 days, 3 days a week, doing some voluntary stuff in the community, whether it's with an Aboriginal dance group in the community, Indigenous football team, coaching a football team, hanging out at with the elders group or the men's group or the community organisation or a government, Indigenous government organisation, but just to break down the barriers of instant. And I've seen it growing up. You know, my mate, he said to me, we were about 21, 22. My best friend, he's an Australian bloke, like white Australian bloke, Irish, English heritage. And he said to me, "Mate," he goes, we were sitting there one time, I don't know where we were having a beer at a pub or something. He goes, "Man," he goes, "I don't know how you how you cope with it. And I said, what's that? He goes, I just remember. He goes, remember when we were growing up? I said, yeah. He goes, how many times were we walking around, like going to a party or something? We'd have a group of friends and boop, pull up. Where are you guys going? You, come over here. You stand over there. Why am I getting, you know? And I'd be like, why are you pulling me up? Why are you stopping me? Shut up. What are you doing? What are you doing hanging around? Why are you guys around here? Why are you here? So it's this, you know, that's half the problem. That, you know, there's a problem, but you've got to look at the cause of the problem. That I think, you know, the cause is just a negative perception or just a stereotype that's stuck in, can get stuck in people's minds. You know, even one I heard years ago about Palm Island. Oh, I'm sitting there at a party talking to some blokes, and the blokes said, oh yeah, I'm going up to Palm Island. I've got a mob up there. Oh, yeah, cannibals, hey, cannibals on Palm Island, I know. Because I never met an Aboriginal person before his life, but his mate had a mate who went up there and worked and got told there were cannibals. You know, someone's probably just taking the piss out of him. And suddenly, so there's, you know, it's like, if you want to find out something, in my head, I don't go to Japan to do a gig and want to find out from the Ainu, you know, about their culture. I don't go, oh, well, I'll just ask another Australian person who's sitting next to me about these Indigenous people. I'll go and talk to the horse's mouth. I don't want to find out secondhand news and have the message watered down or, you know, a stereotype perpetuated over, yeah, anyway.
The foundation stone for all of this is culture, old culture, new culture. Fred, I want to talk to you about corroboree. 3 years ago, you curated 9 different clan groups, 160 dancers, and staged Brisbane's first official corroboree in almost a century. And in some ways, that's tragic. How much has been lost? And what were you trying to reclaim?
Yeah. In terms of culture, it was about 80, it had been 81 years in documented history. That's not to say that there was stuff going on in our communities where mob were getting together, but in documented history, in the CBD of Brisbane, that was the biggest gathering.
And it wasn't just lost, it was suppressed.
It's suppressed,
was
sort
of, yeah. So, pushed aside.
Yeah, so, you know, a lot of the mob now, we have this affectionate name. There's even a book. Michael Ed put together a book of all his pictures over 20, 30 years called The Brisbane Blacks. And the Brisbane Blacks are Aboriginal people from a million, you know, however many tribes there are in the country, over 350 roughly. There's mob in Brisbane from, you name it, just about everywhere, in the Brisbane and the greater region. So that suppression started in the missions, where people like my grandmother, you know, my grandfather were told, you know, you move from your community, you're taken to a mission on someone else's country. And so the only logical thing the missionaries thought to do is, okay, we want them all to get along, and there's an assimilation policy in place, so you'll all learn English and you'll all learn about the Bible and this is God. And what you're talking about over there with culture and talking about Jabu and Wuru and the boys and girls or whatever, never the twain shall meet. You keep your mouth shut on that and you're going to learn this. So it was very much, you know, flogged in our people over a couple of generations.
So you weren't trying to reclaim dance or song. I mean, on the physical level you were, but you were reclaiming something more than
something
that, because corroboree is about lore. It is about the
spirit.
White.
Yeah, it was about giving that. The big thing for me was empowering the community and bringing the spirit back into while we're getting together. There's many different Aboriginal dance groups, Torres Strait Island dance groups from around the region. But we sat down the first year we did it, brought in all the elders. Elders came together and had a yarn, and then brought in all the dance groups. And we're sitting around, and the main focus of this thing for me was, you know, we're competing with everything. Like I talked about earlier, we're competing with social media, we're competing with Facebook, competing with a TV screen, a remote control. How can you make a culture that's 40,000 years old relevant to a person, 16, couldn't give a rat's about what I've got to tell them about.
And he's probably already been in prison once or twice.
Yeah. So, and I know there's a strong identity around, yeah, I'm a black fellow. But then I don't know if you guys have found this, but, you know, you'd ask a young fellow, where's your mom? Oh, well, like, yeah, well, my grandmother's Aboriginal. So, well, that's your Aboriginal. Oh, no, well, that's my grandmother. Well, you're Aboriginal. The same blood that runs through your veins ran through her veins. You know, everything that you're not just one bit. But so just looking at it, so it was that cultural maintenance, cultural preservation, language maintenance, intergenerational transfer of knowledge, making it relevant to young people. So suddenly you take, we call it Yawap our way, all up around southeast Queensland, and you know, traditional dance, it's hard to get family involved, or kids and nieces and nephews say, oh, you know, I hit my nephew up one time, I got really angry because I said, oh, hey, Neff, we're going to have a jam on the weekend and we want to teach you this dance, so all the boys are going to be there, come along. Oh, but I've got to go because such the other cousins are filming, we're filming ourselves scootering out the skate park, and, you know, and that's more important than this. So I said, okay, well, alrighty-o, and I got Gully up and turned away. So I kept thinking, how do you make it relevant? And the mistake I did make once was we did this gig for Indigenous All-Stars jersey presentation. One of my nephews said, oh, I want to come on. I said, no, I've been asking you for a year. Come and sit in the park and talk with us and dance and learn the dances and the language and the songs. And so I told him no. A little while later, uncle of mine, he's passed away now, but he said, Neff, he goes, you made a big mistake there. I said, no. I said, he can't just jump on the boat when it suits him and he's going to get a ticket to see the game. I said, he can't do it. And he said, you made a mistake. He said, you found what was going to engage him. You found it. You had it in your hand. And he goes, and now, you know. So you got to take every opportunity. And we do that. We do that with the music. We do that with the traditional dance. So I didn't want it to be, oh, we're going to get together and do traditional dance. On the turn them into like Bollywood stars, you know, big lights, big sound system, great big sand circle, 2,000 seats. Mob came and were just like, oh my gosh. And then the next year, 16 dance groups. And even that first year, there was 160 on the books. But when Mob rocked up from the community and they saw that their cousins and their uncles were there, boom, where's my noggin? Where's my okay? I'm going to get paid enough there. Boom, boom, boom. And there's suddenly 210, you know, like it's crazy. And then the second year we did it, there was, 255 dancers on the books, 16 dance groups, 32 clan groups in total, roughly represented.
There's a lot of policemen around.
A lot of policemen, yeah.
They all brought them in there.
Shelley, I want to talk to you about the songwomans, the Borroloola songwomen, custodians of your own ancient Indigenous song cycles, and your maternal grandmother, I love this, you described her the other night as the Queen of Darwin, Hilda Muir. She was part of the Stolen Generations, and she was very much part of your re-engagement with your Waterman and Yanyuwa roots. So I want you to tell me about 2011, 2012, and that Borroloola Songwomen project, because what did you have to do to honour the role that you were being asked to perform? Because they were welcoming you back.
Oh, yeah, they were welcoming me back. And but my family are very, very serious law women, and that's L-O-R-E, and very serious in culture. So for me, it was terrifying. Because I'd been working in all these remote communities and doing wonderful work with the children by the time I was embarking on this project with my beautiful grandmothers and aunties, I could sing in 15 Aboriginal languages and Yanyuwa wasn't one of them. And that's my language. So I was terrified. Not because I wasn't terrified of them as people, I was terrified of my lack of knowledge. And because that was it, that's their bone cruncher for us to be committed, because it's a lifelong commitment. We all know that, but it is a lifelong commitment to my family in Borroloola. And so, and they're a long way away from Darwin, and there's lots of things that are lost in translation. So when I arrived, there I was, you know, sitting there with the guitar at the Arts Centre in Borroloola, singing songs in all these different languages. Nah, not happy. And they said, well, now, you got to learn Sing Yanyuwa. And that's when I spoke to the project manager, Patrick McCloskey, and I said, well, how many songs do you want in language? And he said, all of them. And I choked because I had 2.5 weeks to write a whole album in a language I didn't know. And it was, yeah, absolutely terrifying. But during all those trips, I mean, obviously to the Western Desert, to the Pitlands, Mutajulu, Nunandara country, west of, you know, you turn left at Katajuda, the Olgas, and drive for another 8 hours, you know. So I'd done some hard yards in the dust, and so I was really ready for that tough love, I suppose. But family, of course, were very generous and very kind, and, yeah, we got an album done and all in Yanyuwa, and because we've only got 22 speakers left as well in the Yanyuwa language, so it was a really important time to encourage our children to be speaking language. Mm.
You speak or you sing 17 different Aboriginal languages. To anyone other than you, why does that matter?
I fell in love with the bush. I fell in love with it. Was something I never grew up with, and when I heard it, you know, when my family, I first met my sister 18 and a half years ago, maybe 19 years ago, in Kakadu, and they were all the women just were plucking goose and speaking language, I was gobsmacked. I mean, my heart, I was just going, it took me out on yellow waters, took me 15 years to say that, that's why I'm saying it. So I was gobsmacked because my education told me that there was no Aboriginal people left that lived a traditional way, and that was in primary school. And so when I got there, I was floored, and I was upset that I'd never been told from my education.
Not only were they your countrymen, they were your family.
And so, yeah, it's been a I suppose an awkward, loving journey for me, you know, sitting out in the desert. Now, desert people are incredibly strong, but they're incredibly quiet. So I go in with my big smile and go, hi, you know, balya, balya lingo. But, you know, this is what they taught me, was don't react, because it happens when it happens. And so this forward way of me saying hello to you in the front row and being very courteous and kind, it's just like it'll happen when it happens, and you need to let that stuff go. Yeah, just it's been an incredible, beautiful journey, and now I've learnt to wait, and the women will talk to me when they feel comfortable or brave enough, and it's a beautiful feeling to sit out there in the middle of the Western Desert on the red dirt and just wait. And next minute you hear Kunga, Kunga, music Kunga. They call me the music woman, Kunga, in desert way, music Kunga. And then I go and sit with them, and then they give me a baby to hold. And yeah, I feel incredibly at home.
Jabiru, how did you get your clan name? It's your kin name, but how has it worked out? And what does that mean for you now, well, and who you are?
It's that whole identity thing of what happened in Broome, in Coles. So the elder who passed away, Uncle Merv Torres, who then made the connections with everybody.
Your great-grandmother, yep.
Yeah, and he was the one, funnily enough, he says, once he kind of went down the generation, he says, you Jupurula. So it's actually Jupurula, but there's so many of them, I took the LA out because that's like America, LA, Jupurula, LA. Get rid of the American side. So anyway, there's Jupuru, you know. So when you yell out to a bunch of family, and, hey, Jupurula, and then everyone looks at it, hey, which one?
Yeah.
So
that's like okay. Your skin name, eh?
Yeah, skin name. So that's where that name came from. The funny thing about that was Uncle Move was almost instructional, where he says, you know, when you go on the stage and all that, you use that name. Hmm. The thing was, he only knew me then as a sound guy, which was where I started in the whole music game. And that was the only thing I did. I'd be doing what our brother is over there. I'd be at the back with my meat pie and sauce.
I'd like to get a reflection from all of you on Homelands, because Tony Abbott, former Prime Minister, famously told us last year it was a lifestyle choice. I want to get a sense from all of you about what Homelands means, but also one of the great pieces of unfinished business for us as a nation is recognition, and that is going to involve constitutional recognition. So could I start with you and get a sense from you on what recognition will mean for home and those homelands, those remote communities? I mean, does it matter? Is it going to make any difference?
Well, I think the difference has to be made in people, in the Australian, the whole Australian, governments down. I think that's when change is going to happen. Just because something's written down and, you know, whatever the constitutional recognition is, I really don't think that's going to change the way Australia is. Australia has to change, and all these wonderful people here today, thank you, for to be interested in our stories. And I'm not being sorry for myself. I'm thankful that people are open enough. And I think that's where Australia's at today. And that's how I think we're going to make change. We're going to make change on the ground. I don't really have faith, I'm sorry, in governments because of the... Obviously, I've been there through the interventions and all sorts of terrible things that have happened in the Northern Territory. And, that's how I feel. I think change is going to come from the Australian people.
Fred, recognition for you, what difference? What does it mean?
To me, I don't know. I think it's a little bit... I feel a bit disheartened with it. I feel a little bit like it would be tokenistic of a government to recognise something that... we don't have to... You know it. We all know it. You know it as a human being. We all know that we've been here for all this time. It's documented. We don't need to recognise that people, there needs to be change. And so the only way there can be change is, you know, if there was a treaty to force the hand of change, and not just when it's election time, we're going to talk about this and we're elected and now we're just sort of go back to the way things have always been. And that happens too often for, you know, generation after generation. I'm hoping that, you know, there's a light at the end of the tunnel in the next few years with change of guard and, you know, new generation of thinkers coming in and that have grown up in with Aboriginal people and you know, even just as an Indigenous Affairs Minister would be, you know. Isn't that common sense?
Yes. You know what I mean?
It blows my mind.
Yeah, it just blows my mind.
Jupiru, recognition. What does it mean for you?
Well, I'm real happy with, you know, one of the biggest things that happened to us, you know, finding where our roots were. So, you know, that was the most powerful thing that happened. And then when you see everywhere, not just our cousins, nieces, nephews, who are having trouble, who are getting locked up, who are suiciding, all the issues that all of us deal with, for me, it's my job really is to access and hopefully change the next generation. So most of my work with, luckily with the Didge playing, involves touring an average of maybe 60 schools a year, 60 shows, so 60 schools a year in between the festivals. So my thought has always been the future is in those little ones.
The schools before the reform schools, yep. before
and then
the
if
detention
we can get
centers.
To those guys, especially the juvenile centres, there is a Prime Minister, future Prime Minister, who might change things. Right now, yeah, no chance, you know. So I'm my vision of recognition of it has to come from that next lot of generations who will give everybody that level playing field. And, you know, thanks to Charlie, I get to blow my message all around the place. So.
Can I just say one thing? I just wanted to say one thing. You know, I was, I suppose, the most, in a way, perfectly assimilated Indigenous person with my really good English and my excellent phone voice. Good afternoon. Garma Festival, Shelley speaking. I sort of come to realise I wasn't accepted anyway. So finding myself and finding my family and finding my where I belong, it was the most important thing. And of course, the policy just didn't work, you know. And if people are allowed to learn and understand it their own way, you know, then they'll become more, you know, if we had more understanding of cultural stuff here in the room, there'd be a big understanding of you go, oh, I know why they're mob sitting down over there. Because they go, why would I stand up and wait for a bus in the sun when there's a shady tree where I can sit down? So if there's a better understanding of us all and vice versa, my remote community families into the Western world, they're quite removed, it just makes, I think it would work heaps better. Thank you.
You've been listening to Highlights of Rediscovering Roots featuring Shelley Morris, Kucha Edwards, Jupara and Fred Leone. This conversation was presented as part of Heartlands, the cultural stream of the Blue Mountains Music Festival. Our thanks to our moderator, RN's Greg Borschman. And that's the program. In our next edition, Ebola. The outbreak in West Africa caused the death of over 11,000 people. But was the delay in developing vaccines simply because there was no money in it for Big Pharma? Until next time, I'm Paul Barclay. Bye for now.